Today is September 9th, 2022. This is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Ronnie Mac McFarland. Ronnie Mac's last name is spelled M-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Ronnie Mac. How are you doing today?
I'm good, sir. How about yourself?
Pretty good, thank you. Ronnie Mac, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. One of the things I wanted to ask you was what you knew about life before bolts. A lot of iron construction, well, all of it today, I suppose, uses nuts and bolts, high-grade steel. What do you know about actual hot rivets and riveting things?
Well, from the dawn of the structural steel assemblies, whatever, you know, Carnegie kind of perfected his steel making. Everything was made from, you know, laminated plate and angle before we had road members like we have today. So they would, you know, in the shop, they would drill holes.
Okay.
Laminate angles, the plates, depending on what it had to carry. More and bigger plates, bigger and heavier angles to make column and beam type sections out of it for the structures. And there was an art to heat rivets. They had to be a certain temperature for them to work properly. And
so
then there wasn't enough heat guns and thermostats and thermometers and stuff back then. It was all done visually. So the guy that was working the forge or the kettle, you know, heating them up, you know, that was an art. And he might have 10 different sizes being heated up at one time. And as soon as one would be ready, you know, he'd holler out to, you know, guys on the floater at a point, you know, and they had a metal catch can. And he'd grab that rivet with the tongs, and he would throw it, you know, sometimes 60, 90, 100 feet.
Wow.
And catch it with that bucket, grab it with a smaller set of tongs, stick it in the hole, and then they had a deal that's called bucking up. They would put behind it to hold it while the guy on the other side got on it with a hell dog. What they were called is like a mini jackhammer, and pound that thing down and leave that dome rivet head on it. So if the plies were a little bit off or whatever, as long as that rivet went in there and they started hammering it down, whatever voids or differences was in there, that rivet would just fill that void up.
Okay. And would they have to use more rivets than bolts, or is it a, you know, if you were connecting two pieces of steel together, there was a plate, you put the plate on there, there'd be a bunch of holes, you'd line those up and start putting rivets in there to fill up all the holes.
The only way they really use, the count-wise is still about the same now as far as connecting the pieces and holding them in place. Where they used more at was having to rivet the member itself together, because you let have a rivet go like every 3 inches or so, or a double row of rivets just to hold the member together because it was all laminated together.
Okay.
Well, like nowadays we have, you know, road shapes for columns and beams and big beams. I mean, they'll roll up to like a W-44 by, you know, 700 pounds a foot.
Wow. Okay, so let me make sure I understand that. There's a guy working a forge, and he's going to get this rivet white hot. I mean, it's got to be hot.
It'd be glowing orange when he could pull it out there and throw it to the guys.
Okay, and he would call out to them, so they would have to have, as you mentioned, the catch can. They would have to have that ready when he got the tongs and flipped it to them. Now, one of the things I think of right there is if he doesn't throw that thing right and it's off a little bit, the guy with the catcher might want to lean out for it.
And they would have to, and I've seen battle scars from some of them old-timers that would miss, and that rivet would hit them. Of course, you know, it'd just be being hit with super hot branding iron. You know, it'd leave an ugly scar.
Wow. Okay, so that's something else I hadn't thought of. I mean,
it's only testing for just a second or so, but it was so hot when it hit them, it'd leave a mark.
Oh, I bet. I mean, it would burn right through their clothes if it's anywhere near 700 or 800 or 900 degrees. Wow, I had never thought of that. I'd always thought about the danger of reaching out too far to catch the thing. Then you lose your balance and you're on your way down somewhere. I hadn't appreciated.
Most of the guys were sitting down on the beam, so you could hook a foot. You could hook your heel on the backside of the beam you're sitting on. You can lean out there a pretty good ways.
Okay, that makes sense.
Still maintain your balance. And I'd heard that those guys that worked the forge, they got paid a piecemeal so much a rivet.
Ooh.
Which, I mean, they won't let nobody work piecemeal nowadays, but back then, you know, a guy that was real good on that forge, you know, was worth his weight in gold, especially if he could, you know, one forge could feed, you know, five or six different pairs of guys bolting up. You know, and that guy would come in early, make sure he was, you know, had his forge going and had rivets ready, so when everybody else started, he was ready to go.
Got it. That makes sense.
And I've heard, you know, some of them old-timers tell me, you know, the guy on that forge, you know, he'd be making, you know, three times the money that everybody else was making.
Hmm.
You know, a lot of people didn't want it because, I mean, you're just standing in one spot and it's hot in the summertime. It's got its benefits in the winter, but, you know, you're just steadily monitoring that, you know, and chucking them rivets.
Right. I bet you'd get good at it, but still with your wrist, you know, after a while, that's going to start taking its toll. You know, especially when you've got a heavier rivet that might be 5 or 6 inches long, pitching that thing out there is gonna get old after a while.
I've seen videos of them guys, you know, chucking them, and I mean there was an art to it. They grabbed it with that tong, and they knew how to. Wasn't so much the wrist; it was just like from the elbow down, you know, that lower part of your arm.
Okay. Yeah, I absolutely appreciate there's an art to that. And yeah, it'd be nice in the wintertime because you'd be hanging out by something kind of warm, actually pretty hot. But in the summer, oh man. Yeah. Well, I just had not appreciated. If you don't get out of the way of that rivet coming at you and you don't and it beans you, whether it hits you on your arm or your leg, yeah, that's a bad day.
There was an art to every aspect of it, from the guy heating them to the guys catching them and bucking them up. I mean, it wasn't for the faint of heart.
No, and they had to be fairly quick, I would assume, because the rivet, as soon as it left the forge, would be cooling off. And so
yeah, but they had them so hot that you probably had, from the time it left the forge, you probably had 5 minutes.
Okay.
Before it would cool down enough to where it might affect you on the way it would drive up.
Okay. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that either. As soon as you put it in the hole, it's going to start cooling off even more, because now its heat is dissipating into the steel that surrounds it.
Yep.
So then you've got to get on it fast there. So the Hell Dog, the air hammer on one side, and bucking up on the other side, was there a tool that you used for that?
Yeah, it was, maybe 8-10 inches long, and it had like a screw jack on the end, and you could put something behind it for it to buck up against and run that end down before it hit that rivet. And then that way, when the guy got on the other side, you know, it wasn't shoving back on the every lick. You held it tight in there, so when the guy was, you know, hammering it down, you had a lot better effect.
So, okay, help me out with this. I can think. All right, I've got a tool that's, you know, 8-10 inches long, and if I could wedge that tool against something else, then the guy with the Hell Dog can just wail away on this thing, and my rivet's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to back out because I've got it wedged in there pretty tight. But I would imagine there would be a lot of instances where there is nothing to buck that tool up against, and you've just got to lay into it. Is that...
Well, this guy's pretty creative. I mean, sure, in some instance, they had the shop leave a rivet out so far back where they could drop a rod down in there to buck that up against.
Oh.
And then the guys would, you know, once they had the other bolts tightened, then they would put that rivet in.
Okay. Oh, so let me make sure I understand this. Basically, if I could hold the buck-up tool and I could brace it on the other side of the iron with like a claw reaching over, then it wouldn't go anywhere. Then the Hell Dog guy could get it on his side, and the claw would reach over and get it on the Hell Dog guy's side anyway to hold the buck-up tool in place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, they'd have to put something behind the buck up tool to make sure it, you know, it held in place. But I said, those old timers, that's pretty creative.
Wow. Okay. Well, you've inspired me now to get on YouTube and see if I can find a YouTube film on how that's done, or how it was done.
I'm sure there is, because I mean, there's some footage of like when the Empire State Building was being built. Probably some footage of the Golden Gate, the Open Bay Bridge, you know, some of them whenever they was erecting those.
Okay. Okay, cool. Well, thank you. I appreciate that touch back to the past.
And when they would hang the iron, the bolts they would use to hang it to the river guys got there had square heads on them. That's before we had the octagon-headed bolts like we have nowadays.
Oh, so back me up a little bit. What you're saying is that the bolt-up guys would actually use these square-headed bolts, and the rivet guys would then come in and rivet and eventually pull out the bolts and rivet up those holes.
Well, yeah, did it start with the raising game with just hanging it on temporary bolts?
Okay.
bolt up crew would come in and drive pins to line the hose up, and then use a few bolts to make sure the iron was drawn up tight, you know, like on each side of the column or the beam or whatever the members were connecting to.
Okay.
Then as they started putting rivets in them other hoses, then they could take those bolts out.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
And nowadays, you know, we just use bolts. You know, we try to monitor to make sure we're putting the right size in each point, so when the bolt-up crew comes by there now, there's no changing nothing out.
Okay. Oh. So the temporary bolts now become part of the structure.
We don't have temporary bolts now. We just use permanent bolts when we're hanging them.
Right. So when I was thinking of temporary bolts, that's back in the rivet days. So now the raising gang uses real bolts that are going to stay there, and then the bolt up crew comes along and just finishes the rest.
Yep.
Which is what the rivet crew was back in the days of rivets.
Yep.
Okay. All right, that makes sense.
You know, back then, like nowadays, two good bolt-up guys can keep up with one crane hanging iron pretty easy.
Hmm.
Back then, you know, it would take six or eight guys, maybe even 10, to try to keep up with one crane's hanging iron. Just because it took so much longer with having to heat the rivets and the process.
Right. Yeah, I mean, somebody's got to keep the forge guy in coal and in rivets, and keep him supplied up. Somebody's got to catch the rivet. Somebody's got a bucket on one side. Somebody's got a hell dog on the other side. Somebody's got to put the rivet into place. Right now, right there, you've got, you know.
Usually the guy that caught it put it in place.
Okay.
He would catch it, reach in there with a small set of tongs to grab the rivet, stick it in the hole, and then he'd put the buck up tool on it. Then the guy on the other side would, you know, use the hell dog and hammer it tight. And as soon as they're ready, the next rivet was ready, they'd throw him another one.
And in theory, there were, two or three or four of those crews, the guy that's catching and the guy that's bucking it up. And so the forge guy can be throwing rivets to three or four teams, not just two guys. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and on those bigger projects, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised even on the old Navajo Bridge when they did it that they probably had probably two guys on the forges. On that.
Okay.
And then, you know, you get on, like, the bigger bridges, like the Open Bay Bridge or the Golden Gate or some of them. Oh, God, I don't know how many different forges they had going.
Right. That makes sense. So on Navajo, you could have two forges, one on the upstream side, one on the downstream side.
Well, I mean, they erected that, the old one, the same way we did the new one. They did half and then moved over and did the other half. But you'd have, like, say, one up toward the roadway surface and another one probably set up down below.
Oh, you do it that way. Okay.
Or one on one side, one on the other.
Right. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Huh. Yeah, definitely a little faster now without all that, without a forge and you still got pneumatic tools to, you know, tighten up your bolts. But you don't have to wail away on stuff like those guys were doing. That must have been loud. Were those old timers deaf that you were working with? I can't imagine.
A lot of them were, but a lot of the big air impacts we used, you know, in my career, you know, were just as loud, and a lot of guys complained about it, but I mean, I still hear perfectly fine, and I've been around them, you know, my whole career. So.
Did you use ear protection?
No.
Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah, I kind of wonder about, well, rivets just sound like the potential for getting hurt is pretty good. And I imagine that only happens once or twice. You either learn or you hang it up to get hit by a piece of steel that hot. That's the sort of thing a person does not want to repeat.
Well, it's a tough trade. It kept a lot of people out of the trade, didn't have any business being in there. I mean, you separated the men from the boys real quick.
Well, with that kind of thing, I think you'd need to be real dexterous, too. I mean, you have to be quick on your feet to be able to get a really hot piece of steel like that where it needs to go and then pound it into place. You know, you've got to be good. Well, all right, let's move forward then back to 1994. You guys had gotten the Flagstaff side built out and then moved everything? Over to the
everything.
Okay.
To the lodge side.
What went over to the lodge side? What did you move?
We moved the crane that was on the travel frame that we used to erect the bridge with. We moved two 40-foot sea containers that we used to store boats in.
Okay.
Air compressors, gauge boxes, I mean, all tools, everything moved to the other side. And that took probably, it was probably 3 weeks doing all that. I mean, busted the crane down. They had to haul in around the long way. Got everything else moved over. Crane put back together. Ready to start erecting. So it's probably about a 3 week deal in there. We're just getting all that stuff moved and back work ways.
Okay, we talked about this once before, but I want to capture it again. When you mentioned the long way around, can you describe that?
Well, they had the trucks, we'd load them up with the crane and the heavy parts, and they'd have to drive back down to Flagstaff, go to Kingman, go over to Laughlin, up to Vegas, up to St. George, and come down through Fredonia, down by the north rim and down that way to get to the...
Yeah, Jacob Lake?
Yeah.
Okay. Was... I'm also thinking about the bridge at the Glen Canyon Dam. Was that an option to go that way? Or was there a...
Well, we didn't know. A weight restriction or what. I think we should got to get a permit to do it. And of course, they're going to permit you on less travel roads, but that's just the way the ADOT had us permitted.
Okay. That's a long drive around. You mentioned a story about getting some sort of crane across the old bridge. Can you recount that again?
We took that 80-ton hydro that we used to unload trucks and load our dolly platform with material on. We drove it across that old bridge, oh God, probably 4 or 5 times.
Okay. And so the old bridge handled that. I'm assuming you weren't driving it very fast.
Well, no, we had traffic blocked off on both sides. And then me and David Mash walked with the crane across the first 2 times, watching to make sure we wasn't stressing or about to buckle a member down below. After we made a couple trips, we wasn't too worried about it anymore after that.
Okay. And was the 80 ton crane, was it carrying stuff across?
No, it was just carrying itself.
Okay. Why did it have to go?
Started out. We had it on the Flagstaff side, because we had unloaded iron for that half of the bridge on that side.
Okay.
And it would feed our knowledge that we would load material on to take out to the crane, you know, for each panel point as we was erecting it. Well, after we got done and got the traveler crane back to the bank and tore down and it loaded out, when those trucks left, then we had another truck that we'd load one of those 40-foot sea containers that we'd store boats in on it, let him drive across the old Navajo bridge, and then we'd bring the picker across to unload it, and we'd drive back across, and the truck would come, we'd load the other one up. I mean, just...
Got it. So you were running the 80-ton back and forth to unload the containers and other stuff.
Yep.
Got it. Okay.
And by the time the trucks made the route around and got back in there, we'd already set the first 2 short spans out from the abutment going toward the cut in the cliff. We had that set and the trackway laid out, so when the crane parts started showing up, we could put the traveler frame together and then put the crane together on top of it.
Okay. All right, so the crane, the building crane, you were able to assemble that, put it back together to get out to the first panel off of the skew back foundations.
Well, it was back, you know, 30 feet or so before you got to the cut where the first tall plumb posts come up from the anchorage.
Okay.
He'd reach around behind him, grab a plumb post. Well, we set the shoes first.
Yep.
Then he'd reach around behind him, grab a plumb post, bring it over to us. You know, and we'd set it to the shoe, and then we had a temporary brace that we would put a against the cut back toward it to help hold it in place till we got up there high enough we could tie it back to the structure before you got to the main span of the bridge.
Okay. So the plumb posts weren't full height. They were sections?
Yep, I think three.
Okay. Okay, so once that's built up high enough, then you can get it back into the tie backs, bolted into the land to keep them from tumbling down into the river.
Yep. And that took us, we was probably 3 or 4 days setting that in the first panel point out. And then we'd move the rig ahead and then set the next panel point. And those were the taller ones. So we'd be about a day and a half after we got the first one built, setting them. And then after like the third panel point, we'd do a panel point a day.
As they got smaller?
Yeah.
Okay. So it seems like within a couple of weeks, you would have just marched right on out there.
Yep, it didn't take long.
You mentioned that
everybody kind of learned the drill by then, so they knew what to do and every step and all that. So it was already past the learning curve.
Yeah, from the other side, you guys were sort of...
Started a new project. You got guys that's never done it before, especially if it's a complicated structure. You got to go through the learning process to teach them, you know, what to do, what to look for,
right.
All that good stuff.
Ronnie Mack, you had mentioned Ed Kent, the superintendent of the job, had a rock he sat on to kind of watch what was going on the Flagstaff side. Did he find a similar rock on the Lodge side?
Yes, he did.
And he called out a couple things on the Flagstaff side. You mentioned that in an earlier interview. Did he call out some things on the Lodge side as well?
Oh, yeah. If he thought we weren't going fast enough, he'd be on there. Be on that radio. You need to do this, or you need to do that, or what's taking so long?
Okay.
I mean, just typical old bridge superintendent.
Okay.
It don't matter how fast you're going, it ain't never fast.
Oh, that's a. That makes sense, I suppose. As a superintendent, it's like, come on, get going. Oh, you're going fast? Well, go faster. Yeah.
Yeah, and I had to remind them on that second half. They got to be a little too gung-ho, and I'm just like, hey, remember when I got here, if you got a panel point every 3 days, you was happy. Now you're getting a panel point a day, plus all the floats jumped, the dolly reloaded. I mean, you know, gotta be careful what you wish for. You should go back to 3 days of panel point.
Wow. And was that 3 days of panel point, was that because people were new to what was going on and didn't quite have a, you know, have the system figured out?
No, I think that's what was allowed in the original schedule.
Okay. Well, take me off to a little rabbit hole for a minute. Because if I know the schedule is I got 3 days to build the next panel out, and I can do it in a day, I'm going to lose 2 days of pay if I do that.
But, you know, when you're in supervision, you don't look at it that way. So the whole deal is, you know, make the company money. So if you can do it in a day versus 2 days, you save them 2 days worth of pay for all the guys and equipment cost and all of that. So, I mean, it makes a big difference at the end of the job. And that's why they called the foreman, you know, pushing a crew, because you got to keep pushing them, otherwise they'll just lay down on them.
Okay, so the crew's incentive is to drag their feet to get that extra day's pay. Superintendent's trying to get ahead of what's been scheduled, because when a job's done, like you say, it's expensive for renting equipment and paying salaries for the crews that are out there. If the job is done sooner, you're still going to get the same amount of money to build the bridge. The employees aren't, because they're going to finish up sooner.
Yeah, but a lot of times, too, the incentive, like for the superintendent, and I've done a lot of projects to where my bonus would be based off of unused man hours.
Okay.
So, you know, and it would vary per job, but most of the time, my standard deal would be like 30% of the unused man hours.
Would the raising gang,
for say, three days a panel point, and I was doing it in a day, well, then by the time the job's done, say I had saved them, you know, 30,000 man hours or 5,000 man hours or whatever it was. You know, it could mean anywhere from a $5,000 bonus to a $60,000 bonus.
Okay.
And it really didn't cost the company anything, because it was all in the extra profit I had made them.
Right.
So they made all of their profits that they had hoped for when they did it, plus extra.
Got it.
And I've done a few jobs with that same deal, and when we get to the end and they find out how much my bonus was, then they'd want to renege on the deal.
Hmm.
You know, the greed factor was set in on it.
Hmm. Ronnie Mack, would the raising gang and the bolt-up crews, would those guys see some of that bonus as well if they busted it out and...
A lot of times, yes. You know, especially if you have, you know, company guys that work for you all the time and travel with you.
Uh-huh.
You know. And I'd usually try to make that part of my deal, too. You know, once I knew what, you know, what mine was going to be, I'd just be like, okay, here's a list of guys. I want them to get something.
Okay.
You know, whether it be, you know, $2,500 or $5,000 or, you know, whatever, just it let them know they was appreciated.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Because if you're ahead of schedule and, you know, the money's going to be made anyway, hey, you know, reward that crew. Yeah, okay. So,
not every company does that.
Hmm. Well, I bet the iron workers figured that out pretty quickly. Who actually is generous that way and who is not? And
is it what I do? If they don't have a bonus incentive, well then I just up my hourly rate. Kind of compensate for that.
Oh, okay.
Because you still got the same amount of heartburn to run the job.
Right.
You know, and if they don't care enough about the guy running it to kind of give him an incentive to do good and watch job costs and make a profit. Well, then my duration with them guys would be very short-lived.
So it must have been kind of exciting when you guys were just a couple panels out, closing up that gap.
Well, I mean, they were taller, but there's probably only, maybe 20 more pieces than the shorter panel points. Because you had some horizontals that went from panel point to panel point. And then at the panel point line, you had vertical X bracing that went in there. That's why it usually takes about a day and a half to set those.
Okay.
Because of the extra pieces you had. And then once, you know, you drop down, it wasn't just going any faster. You just had less pieces to deal with, which made everything just go that much faster.
Right. Yeah, once there's sort of three tiers. And the further out you go, suddenly there's two tiers, and the further out you go, then there's one tier, the last top tier.
Yeah, and then I forget now, and I stopped by there when I went home a couple of weeks ago. Then you got four or five panel points. It's just top and bottom cord. It got short enough they didn't need the extra horizontals in there to help stabilize the taller plumb post.
Okay.
And that's their function. It's just, you know, the taller the plumb post is, it's got to have horizontal support so it don't want to buckle under load being that extra length. So that's their function and why those are in there.
Okay. I don't follow you, but I would if we were standing there and you were pointing with your finger.
Well, you only do so much over the phone.
Yep, that's right. When you got the two, well, when you got the lodge side, like you had one more panel to go, was it pretty clear that the alignment looked pretty good, or did you have to start kind of tweaking things a little bit to bring that alignment together?
We had to tweak it because you got the flagstaff side just hanging out there. It just can't leave it out, just hanging out in space.
Right.
So when the sun comes up in the morning, you know, it just draws that bridge toward the sun, and it would pull that bridge over, you know, maybe 6 inches out there on the end.
Wow.
And about or so, it would come back to about center where it belonged, and then late in the day, it would pull it to the west.
Okay.
So then when we got out there to make closure, what we call it when you're tying the two halves together, but we got the crane and the traveler on the lodge side. So that extra weight is making that side droop down more than what the other side is.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we went to set those last bottom cords and get it where that pin would line up and all that. David Mesh would work the jacks on the lodge side that was holding us back. And then Ed Cross would work the jacks on the flagstaff side, get up on this one, let out on that one to get them pulled around and elevations before they mashed up, before they were married together.
I mean,
and even as complicated as that sounds, it really wasn't that bad. It probably took us maybe an hour, hour and a half to get it perfect.
Okay.
But Ed Kent was out there in the middle, and he would tell us, you know, okay, downstream Flagstaff side, add a shim. Well, we'd get up on that jack and add a shim. Then we'd let back off on it, and he'd read it and say, okay, rod side, upstream side, need to take a shim out or add it or whatever, you know, and it just, we're just doing about a shim, so about a quarter at a time. That was about the smallest shim we had, was a quarter.
Quarter inch?
So we'd just do it in quarter inch increments, you know, tweaking, you know, one side and the other till we got them lined up, and then, you know, and then they'd get so mangled. I think we can make it there. Well, then we'd head back out to the center, get the splices tied together, slide the pin in there.
So I'm kind of working out the math. Well, not really in my head, but I'm thinking if you moved a quarter inch over at the rock foundation side, that...
Oh, it would be, it'd be inches out there in the middle.
Yeah, it would move a lot out there.
Yeah.
Huh. And you've got the temperature differential playing with it, so...
That steel will expand 1/8 for every 10 feet for every 10 degrees above 75.
Okay.
So you got to take all that into account.
And once the, and so once these pins are in place, the pins, if I get this right, are about, what, 2 feet long and, I don't know, 4 inches in diameter?
No, they're probably 12, 14 inches in diameter.
Oh, a lot bigger.
It would be close to 3 foot long.
Okay. And there's one on the downstream side and one on the upstream side.
Yep. And there just looks on the new one.
Right, so...
They're not doing anything structurally. Now, the old bridge, each half is bearing again that pin.
Right.
But they wanted the new one to resemble and look like the old one. So they put the pin in there. I said, this only function is just for aesthetics.
So once it was in, then they actually bolted across the two halves and just made them into one then?
Well, the way the splice plates were made, like for the bottom cord, for that they married together.
Yep.
Those splice plates were long enough to catch both sides, both bottom cords.
Okay.
So that's why it took so much longer to line that up, is because you had to get those bolt holes to line up where you could bolt them together.
Wow.
And then, you know, once we could start driving pins, you know, and getting it tied in there, then the big pin for looks, it just slid right in there. Then there was a keeper plate that keeps it in there, keeps it from falling out from road traffic and vibration and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Keeps it from going upstream or downstream and falling out.
Yeah.
Okay. So that day when you put those two halves together, did you go ahead and bolt those splice plates in?
Oh yeah.
Okay. So the end of that day that was done.
Yep.
Now there's a picture. I think I sent you that photo, and you very kindly were telling me some of the names of the people in that picture. It sounds like that all was done about, I don't know, mid-afternoon or something like that.
It was probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon time we got, you know, both sides married together.
Okay.
Then we went to the lodge and started drinking whiskey.
Right. Because he wasn't going anywhere, finally. That bridge wasn't going to go anywhere.
Huh. And then we went in the next day and, you know, finished hanging the iron and all that good stuff. Get ready to start moving the crane back to the... to the abutment side so we could tear it down. But, I mean, the crane was out there for probably 3 days after we set out, because we used it to get all the floats jumped out of there and, you know, pull track up as we moved it back.
Okay. So the pins are on the bottom cord, and then you'd bolted that together, and so to finish the iron, you would have had to then build up to the top cord,
top cords just terminate at the plumb post. You got a plumb post like on each side that's holding the top cord up.
Okay.
So that's their expansion is the top. The top's not tied together, so that would allow for any thermal expansion and that kind of stuff.
Ah, okay. So there's a little bit of freeboard, or a little bit of wiggle room for the top cord, but the bottom cord is bolted together.
Yeah, because the bottom cord's all in compression. That's what's holding everything up.
Okay, right. That makes sense.
And then the top cord is just holding the roadway.
Got it. So it has no need to connect side to side. It could, but it doesn't have to. All right, so then you had to pull up the craneway, the crane had to back out. Now, when that crane backed out, the lodge side of the bridge would have wanted to come back up because it didn't have that crane holding it down.
No, but we had it locked together at the bottom cord.
So it didn't matter?
No.
Wow. That's some pretty tough construction there.
It would have came up some, but it would have been compensated with having to pull the other side up
right
as well.
So I guess that would have put the whole bridge then in a little bit of a kind of like a semi-trailer. It kind of has an arch in it, and then when you load it up, it flattens out.
Yeah, it's called camber.
Okay, so the bridge, once the crane backed out, would have then cambered up a bit.
Well, no, not really, because once we had everything made and bolted up, we released the jacks that were holding it together.
Oh, okay, all right.
So then it was all this dead load for what it was designed for.
Okay.
You know, and those bridges are designed to have bumper-to-bumper loaded semis in each lane from one end to the other.
Wow. Okay.
Plus a safety factor.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah, I was thinking about the old bridge in the 1950s when Reclamation was building the Glen Canyon Dam. They would have used that Navajo bridge to get stuff from one side of the canyon to the other.
Well, when they did the Glen Canyon Dam and that bridge, they used a high line system. Once the high line system was up, it could grab material from either side.
Right. Okay. But before that bridge was built, and the high line system was up to swing steel back and forth across the canyon.
Well, I don't know who done the Glen Canyon Dam, so I'm not sure which route they would have come, bringing their material in there.
Right. They had the train in Flagstaff, but they did a lot of stuff in from Kanab, so they would have had to work that out. Anyway, that the Navajo Bridge would have been heavily used to help them connect, you know, whatever they got to do one side or the other side. I was just kind of pondering that the other day. But now with the new Navajo Bridge and the Glen Canyon Bridge at the Glen Canyon Dam, that kind of helps a lot just to have fairly heavy-duty bridges there now in place. Did you have any... I'm sorry, go ahead.
That bridge there at Grand Canyon, that would have been a nice one to work on.
Yeah, there's a...
I think they built that, what, like in the early 60s or something?
No, that was in the 50s. That thing went up really early on in that project. Because they knew they needed to get across the gap. They had, you know, cables across and all that kind of stuff, and they were swinging out giant loads of concrete and all that stuff. But that bridge went in pretty quickly, 57 or 58. I have to look. But it was early up.
I'd be curious to see who the erector was on it.
I could probably figure that out and get that to you. There's a picture I saw. I think I know where to go find it, of the Raising Gang standing out there when the two halves came together. There's a good dozen guys out there. Of course, there's no ropes, no safety netting, nothing. They're just standing out there. I'll send that to you.
They were pretty adamant about the safety nets, even way before, you know, any kind of the tile and stuff that we have nowadays come into play.
I'll have to look for that, because I'm sure it was there, but I don't remember seeing it, so I'll have to look. I'll send you what I've got for that, and you can take a look. It'd be interesting to see what you say when you see that, what it makes you think of. Because, yeah, that would have been in the late 50s, and I'm assuming they bolted that. They didn't rivet it.
No, that was a rivet job.
It was? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Bolts really didn't come into play until mid-60s.
Okay. All right, huh. So what do you think, I just keep thinking about Ed Kent and his tombstone. Just four letters, it says Kent, and then there's that design of the second bridge. The crane's out there. There's a little gap between the flag side and the lodge side. What do you think that bridge build meant to Ed?
Well, all of them meant a lot to Ed, because he took a lot of pride in being a good bridgeman.
Okay.
Yeah, but that was getting close to the end of his career. The way we did it, you just don't do very many of them across the canyon like that, where you can't use the big derricks or the big cranes on the barges and stuff like most of them are done.
Okay. Yeah, you couldn't touch the bottom.
Yeah, if you got a picture of Ed's headstone, I'd like to see it.
Okay, I'll send that. Do you have any thoughts now looking back on that build and amongst all the other builds that you've done?
It's just another job 28 years later.
Okay. Yeah.
When I was driving home a couple of weeks ago, I stopped there, you know, walked across the old bridge looking at it, you know, reminiscing about, you know, when we built it. Then I got to adding up, and I was like, holy shit, that's 28 years ago.
Wow.
Like it's been that long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. Well, I mean, that's why Ed's gone, and
Ed Pence's gone, Ed Cross is gone, Greg Reese is gone.
Yep. Yep.
The only ones left is the crane operator, Andy, David, and myself. Fortunately, all the guys that worked on it, they're still alive.
Right. Right. Where is Andy? How would I get in touch with him?
I'm friends with him on Facebook.
Yeah, can you connect us up?
I'll see if I can get a hold of him.
That would be great. Thank you. Thank you. And if you're heading across the Marble Canyon Bridge sometime soon, I'd be honored to drive up there and meet you and get my little recording gizmo and just have you kind of point some things out to me if you'd be willing.
Yeah, that's fine.
That would be fun. When do you think that might be happening?
Well, I never get done with the decking on this bridge I'm on. Probably sometime around the 1st of October.
Okay. All right, well, let's keep that in mind. Because that would help me just kind of with you pointing out stuff, and it'd be an honor to have you talk about the build from the old bridge looking at the new bridge. That would be fun. Ronnie Mack, is there anything else about this build that you want to add to this oral history?
I think we've covered about everything there is to cover.
Well, I've sure tried. I catch this. There's few people around that remember that build that you did, and I really appreciate your taking the time to go through this in such detail. It's an honor to spend time with you and have you recall this and how it all worked out. I'm very grateful for you taking the time to do this.
I'm just glad somebody thinks enough of it to want to do a history on it.
Well, I wish somebody had taken the time to do it on the first build. And,
That was like during the Depression. People were just happy to have a job.
Well, that's true. We don't think about it at the time, and suddenly it's too late. So, again, I appreciate your taking the time to do that. Well, Ronnie Mack, this has just been really wonderful. Thank you again for doing this with the Grand Canyon Oral History Program. I think with that, we'll go ahead and conclude this series and end part 4 of an oral history with Ronnie Mack McFarlane. Today is September 9th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Ronnie Mack, thank you so very much.
You are very welcome, sir.